Okay, our discussion of the wisdom of Solomon. This is the final chapter. We're about to discuss chapter 19. I think that the defining moment of the wisdom of Solomon, because he's had all this buildup of the explanations of idolatry and the seeking of true wisdom, which is from God, and the importance of following his commandments and his law, and the people whom he chose to do so, the Israelites, time and again throughout their experience in Egypt, and especially in the Exodus, which is a paramount example of his mercy on the children of Israel, while the Egyptians represented the world's idolaters, and they were all destroyed. And they were destroyed in a manner in which they were punished by the very same things that they worshipped, by their sins. They were punished as a result of their own sins. So the defining moment comes in verse 24, the last verse of chapter 18, the next to last verse, where Solomon had said, "For upon a garment reaching to the feet," that's a reference to the long garment of the high priest, "was the whole society," or the whole world, that's the same word translated world in the New Testament, "and the glory of the fathers carved upon the four rows of stones, and your majesty upon the diadem of his head." When you see that garment, as it's described in the book of Exodus, and the stones, there wasn't a picture of the planet on that garment. There was no representation of anything but the children of Israel, those four rows of stones. That was the only thing on that garment. So basically, in that verse, Solomon is equating the whole world or the whole society to the four rows of stones, which represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And in the book of Exodus, there's a direct reference to those four rows of stones that are upon the garment of the high priest. And that's the only thing upon that garment. So that's the only thing which Solomon could have been referencing when he wrote this verse. So he's defining that word world for us. And that's the way I've always interpreted it in all of my New Testament translations, because it doesn't refer to the planet. It refers to the world of the children of Israel. The world, which another reference to that in the opening paragraph of chapter 19 in verse 6, another definition of the world word, the word world, using slightly different language, the word cosmos, I should say, which basically is the world, and it's using slightly different language. So Solomon's, the height of this work of wisdom is the fact that Yahweh God chose the children of Israel out of a sinful world, which really merited nothing but destruction because of its idolatry. And that's the point we're at now, and he's going to continue to summarize that for us as we go into the last chapter here, chapter 19, where we also see a mention of Egypt and allusions to Sodom. Just like the revelation of Yahshua Christ compares Mystery Babylon and today's present world system to Egypt and to Sodom. That's all I have to say. That's where we're at. And that's the purpose, basically, of the wisdom of Solomon.
Okay. "But for the impious, unmerciful wrath until the end, since he knew beforehand even the things coming of them, that permitting them for which to depart, and having escorted them with haste, they being regretful shall pursue them. For while still having sorrows at hand and lamenting at the graves of the dead, they were persuaded by another foolish reasoning. Even those whom being supplicated had departed, them they pursued as fugitives. Indeed, a fitting necessity had dragged them to this end and applied a forgetfulness of the things which happened, that the punishment lacking would be added to fill their torments, and that your people would be tried by an incredible journey. But they would find a strange death. For the whole creation within its own race was again perfectly formed from above, serving your commandments in order that your sons may be kept unharmed. The cloud overshadowing the camp, and then from of the water, which had stood previously, an emergence of dry land had appeared, an unhindered way out of the Red Sea, and a field with grass out of a violent wave, through which all the nation had passed, being sheltered by your hand, having beheld marvelous wonders. Indeed, they had been pastured like horses, and leapt about as lambs, praising you, O Yahweh, he who delivers them. For they reminded themselves still of the things in the sojourn. Indeed, how instead of a species of animals, the land brought forth fleas. And instead of providing water, the river discharged a multitude of frogs. Then, at a later time, they saw also a new species of birds, when having been led by desire, they asked for delicate meats. Indeed, for a consolation to them, the quail mother had ascended from the sea, and the punishments had come upon the sinners, not without the proofs which happened before with the force of thunderbolts. For righteously they suffered in their own iniquities, since they also had contrived a more severe hatred of guests. I think I'll stop there.
Yeah. Well, going back to the very start, we have he knew beforehand even the things coming of them. So this reminds me of the men of old for this condemnation that Jude speaks of. There are certain men who have been judged beforehand because God already knows their origin, and they're already being judged and condemned from of old. I think
their origin and their works. I mean, the Egyptians were Adamic for the most part. We have no reason to really believe they weren't. Go ahead, Joe.
Doesn't Jude connect their sin to the fallen angels too? These men of old who are condemned?
Yes, I mean, Jude doesn't mention Sodom. He does. He doesn't mention Egypt explicitly, but he's basically talking about all of those who reject Yahweh God in general, and the path they take, gainsaying of Korah, it is one of those examples. And Korah was a son of Aaron, or a grandson. I might be wrong. He's a son or a grandson. He's very closely related to Aaron. I think he's a son. So he wanted to set up his own priesthood. Aside from the priesthood that Yahweh had ordained. So that's an act of rebellion.
It's idolatry, isn't it?
Yes, it is idolatry, because you're purposely departing from the way of God and creating your own way. Then you must be a god. You're assuming that you can take the place of God. If he ordains something from us and we make our own choice and choose to depart from that and go our own way, then yeah, that's idolatry.
And like a different priesthood too, that would be idolatry because it's not ordained by God.
Right, and he wanted to lead the people into it.
It's sort of why Jude compares Korra to Cain.
Yeah, exactly, because Cain tried to steal the priesthood from his brother Abel, who it belonged to righteously. That's a good point. The battle of the priesthood, we're always seeing this battle of the priesthood through history. In chapter 19, where it speaks of an tried by an incredible journey.
Yeah, I think we saw that language in a previous chapter, didn't we? Incredible journey.
Unknown journey. So we had the unknown journey in the previous chapter, and God was guiding them through the unknown journey. But now we find that we're tried by an incredible journey, and that is the way they came out of Egypt. They were tried by that journey as they came out, tried by the wilderness. Are you still here, Bill? Or
no, I'm listening. I'm listening intently. I didn't know that you didn't have anything that you didn't want to say.
What?
It sounded to me like you wanted to talk, so I didn't have any need to say
That's
anything.
That's all right. Yeah. Well,
we have plenty
I've
of
time
to chapter this evening. Go
What's
on.
What's that, Bill? Well, the last comment I had was on this, the second paragraph where it says the whole nation passed through. Doesn't Paul speak of that to Galatians? Like you said, we were tried by we were with Moses under the cloud.
That's the Corinthians,
it's in Corinthians. Yeah, there you go. So
chapter 10.
The whole nation passed under the cloud. It's not like all nations on earth had this experience and had this law from Moses. Rather, the word of God only came to this one nation. And the law of God only came to this one nation. They would only identify with this passing through the sea.
Yeah, well, it's Paul only even says their fathers
passed through the sea. So it's only one nation that does that. That's nationalistic, isn't it? So it's not universalist, it's nationalistic.
Well, absolutely. And where much of the race was corrupt, I can't say that the entire race was corrupt. I mean, you had people, a lot of people on the fringes of the Adamic race around Mesopotamia and in Southern Europe. You had the Thracians, the Ionians, the Persians and others, the Medes and others that weren't in the middle of the Canaanites, but probably had some contact with Canaanites for certain. But I can't say that they were all racially corrupt, but Paul said in the book of Acts, I think it's in Acts chapter 14, that Yahweh God gave all the nations, meaning those Genesis 10 nations, the opportunity to seek him, and they all went after their own way. They didn't seek him. He chose Israel and the seed of Abraham out of that corrupt world, that the world of the Genesis 10 nations. And a lot of them had mixed themselves with the Canaanites, the Rephaim, the Nephilim. So we just can't tell to what extent that happened. We don't know. They are gone. And the only nations, that the white nations that survive, are chiefly from the children of Israel. There may be other Adamic people mixed in among them, but we can't distinguish them as a peculiar tribe or nation. They're gone. Those Genesis 10 nations are all gone. They were either absorbed into the nations of Europe, or they disappeared, or were bred out, as in the case of the remaining Egyptians.
Isn't that verse?
So Solomon is saying that this whole creation, this Adamic creation, within its own race, meaning that the children of Israel at this time were not mixed with Canaanites or Nephilim, was again perfectly formed from above and given the commands so that his sons kept unharmed to preserve the race.
Yep. Yeah, it had to be perfectly formed again from a new build because the last, just before the flood, they were all corrupt and they didn't have this commandment from God. And so now they're perfectly formed again, anew. I forget what you say in your commentary, but this isn't very well translated in the KJV, is it? It was from above here.
No,
from
it's above, not. It's whereas called, in the KJV. It's horrible in the King James.
It has again anew, doesn't it? Whereas it should be from above, anothen. So it should be from above. But in the KJV, I believe it has again, which isn't a good translation, anew.
Right. It's again.
Or anothen.
The word again here, it is the word palin, P-A-L-I-N. Palin, anothen is the phrase. And palin literally does mean again. But anothen literally means from above.
So not anew. Can't mean anew.
No, it's ridiculous.
They kept their John 3 interpretation.
Yeah. But that's the thing, Sorry, Bill, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I guess they had to. Go on, Joe.
Well, this time the creation is being given commandments to keep them unharmed, whereas the previous society had to be destroyed because they transgressed the commandment of God not to touch the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Right. Right. Well, that's exactly it. The Genesis 10 nations, there's lessons there that I didn't even really generalize on in my commentary. But I had this second start at Babel, and they were all separated, but when they had that second start, it was really at the beginning just Noah and his three sons, and he had to transmit his knowledge, and he had to know the reasons for the flood, and he had to transmit that to his sons and grandsons. And these people were living for a long period of time. Noah lived for 300 years after the flood. So he must have seen three or four generations of his own children, and he must have transmitted his knowledge to them. Sitting around the table at night or the campfire at night, they didn't have television. They had plenty of time for fathers to teach their children, which is proper, which is the way our society should function. Even if it's just about woodworking or auto mechanics or something. He had plenty of time to transmit all of his knowledge in the accounts of their history to his descendants. So instead of maintaining that culture and maintaining the way to please the God that saved Noah from the flood, they went right back into idolatry. And within 1,300 years, you have Abraham. And he's being chosen out of an idolatrous, corrupt world once again. And some parts of it are corrupt to the extent of Sodom, which had to be destroyed. So Sodom is used in this chapter as an example, along with Egypt, the fate of Egypt, and in the Revelation, and I'll actually pull up the example or the passage in Revelation chapter 8. It's speaking about the two witnesses, the two olive trees, and how they're destroyed by this beast system, and their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. That's not necessarily a reference to Jerusalem. That's a reference to the great cities of the world that hate God and crucify his witnesses and killed him. That's revealed in Revelation chapters 12 and 13, especially in chapter 13, where we read of that same great city and the dragon that gives its power to the beast. And it's the dragon that sought to kill Christ and the Christ child in Revelation chapter 12, and also would make war against the woman and her seed. That dragon, Sodom, this Egypt, they're all people. They're people. They're the descendants of the ancient Nephilim that have rebelled against God from the beginning. They're the people that Jude was speaking about when he spoke about men that were condemned from of old, but the Egyptians and all the other nations that went off into paganism joined themselves to those men. They followed after their ways. That's why the children of Israel were repeatedly warned not to follow the ways of the Canaanites, because the Canaanites were also Nephilim. Forever rebels against God, forever seeking to corrupt his creation. And that's why the whole creation was formed again from above in the children of Israel at Mount Sinai. So where we see the world in later scriptures, the world is the children of Israel. As it states here in chapter 18, verse 24, and in chapter 19, verse 6. The children of Israel are biblical world.
Yeah, there's this new world that's formed from above with the commandments of God, as opposed to the idolatrous world, which was destroyed, had their fill of torments, their punishment. So this is indeed a fitting necessity had dragged them to this end and applied a forgetfulness of the things which happened. That's Egypt, isn't it, Bill? They forgot their torments and went ahead and tried to destroy pursued the Israelites, didn't they?
Right, that they didn't want to let them go, right? As soon, even though they suffered those great punishments, they still fought against God. They should have realized by then, you'd think after the plagues of frogs and flies and all the other plagues they suffered, you'd think they wake the hell up and realize that Yahweh is God, that he really is God, because their own magic tricks pale in comparison. He must be God, and they refuse to acknowledge it.
You know,
After the passing over of the angel of death and the death of the firstborn of Egypt, they still refuse to acknowledge it. They still pursued the Israelites, the fleeing Israelites. Go ahead, Noble.
I was just going to say, I'm sure if we had a parallel situation today and there were pillars of fire, I'm sure the Jews would be like, oh, it's a solar flare. It's like a really powerful, extraordinary solar flare, but there's a scientific reason for this. People would just say, oh, there has to be a scientific explanation. People would turn to their idolatry again.
They will never see the judgment that is coming.
Yeah.
Well, there's one last thing here that I see is after the world's perfectly formed above, again, right, we have this, the emergence of the dry land in the very next verse, in verse 7. So this dry land's coming up out of the sea, and it's kind of like when God created the world and the dry land's coming up out of the waters. So he's definitely forming like this new world. Like it seems like there's a... it's hearkening back to that in Genesis when this new world is formed again.
Yeah, and we see that in Revelation, the sea is no more. So we have like a new world again.
an unhindered way out of the Red Sea. So they're not going to stop us. No way.
No way.
And there's going to be a dry land which emerges from the sea, even perhaps the Red Sea, right? This is the promised land, I'm supposing. Or it's similar to where God created the land in Genesis, where they, you know, he divided the waters from the land, similar to that.
It's sort of interesting because Solomon here, he mentions a field of grass. And if I remember correctly, Josephus said the same thing in Antiquities, which is sort of hard to read because you don't know what to trust when you're reading it. But I think Josephus also mentioned that when the sea parted, there was a field of grass and they followed it, likely seaweed or something.
That is an interesting verse. A field with grass out of a violent wave. What does that mean? So a field of grass is emerging out of a violent wave. I mean, is that it? Just like the dry land appeared.
I like to think it's seaweed or like some sort of algae or something.
No, I think Solomon's just making a poetic allegory that even though the Israelites had been passing through the sea, that they were comforted with a field of grass.
Okay.
It's a poetic allegory.
It's like entering the promised land through trial.
An unhindered way out of the Red Sea.
Oh, unhindered,
and a field
yeah.
of grass out of a violent wave. They had gone out of the Red Sea into the field of grass.
Sort of like they're going to pasture. You know, like sheep.
Yeah, they had an unhindered way out of the violent wave into the field of grass. It's a parallelism written in a very poetic manner.
Yeah, it does remind me of those prophecies of Israel entering the promised land and they're all jumping and leaping around and entering into pasture. And none will make them afraid, and so on.
Yeah, and we have that promise again in Christ, in Malachi 4, you'll grow up as calves in the stall.
I stepped away for a minute. Did you discuss quail mothers at all?
No, I didn't. I can briefly.
I think it's important, but it's up to you.
Well... If it's important, it's only to show how boneheaded the denominational Christians are for not looking into the term. It's actually a quail mother. It's not a quail. And it's an odd bird that follows the flocks of quail around for some reason that we're given this name quail mother. That It's obvious throughout the wisdom of Solomon that these quail mothers are not birds that are typically eaten, where quail are birds that are typically eaten. And here it even demonstrates that they're not typically eaten, where it basically calls them a new or unique type of bird. I sort of lost what verse it was in.
Delicate meats. It's verse 11.
Well, they ask
indeed for consolation to them. The quail mother had ascended from the sea. So they're desiring delicate meats, and then all of a sudden, these quail mothers march up out of the sea, and they're like, "Yes!"
Yeah,
and
it's not
bounce on them,
and it's not delicate
right.
at all.
But they were called a new species of birds, and the people didn't like eating them. They ate them, but they didn't like it. Right.
Right, and the reason behind that, though.
Go on.
To punish him a little bit.
No, I was wondering if you would. Yeah, well, to let them know not to ask for too much and be satisfied with what they have, the manna.
I agree.
I'm sure one guy looked at these birds coming up out of the sea and was like, look at them. No way, guys. No way. Don't fall for it. Look at them, eh? And they're coming up out of the sea, and it's like, this is just too good. Don't eat the quail mothers, guys. It would have just been too random. too strange. It just seemed like a punishment from the start, to be honest. I can understand they were hungry, they wanted a delicate meat, and then these birds come up out of the sea. It just seems like a funny situation to me.
And they ended up not enjoying them very much.
Yeah, and it's great that, you know, Yahweh did that, because he's discouraging him from boiled brats.
You want to finish the chapter, Noble?
Yeah, okay. For indeed those others, not knowing, did not hospitably receive those present. But these had enslaved guests who were benefactors. And not only, but there shall be a certain visitation of them, since hatefully they received the strangers. And they having admitted with festivities those whom already having been partakers of their customs, had mistreated them terribly in labors. So with blindness they were stricken, just as those at the doors of the righteous man, when having been enveloped in gaping darkness, each had sought a passage through their own doors. For the elements themselves being adapted, just as tones on a harp, changing the expression of the rhythm, always abide in a sound, that very thing is to be inferred from the precise appearance of the things which transpired. For the dry lands were changed into waterways, and swimming things traversed upon the earth. Fire had strengthened water by its own power, and water had forgotten its quenching nature. Conversely, the flames do not waste the flesh of perishable creatures walking about, nor melt the easily melted crystalline type of immortal food. For by all things, O Yahweh, you magnified and honored your people, and did not despise them, standing by them in every time and place. Interesting comparison to Lot and his experience.
Yeah, because in some ways Egypt was worse than Sodom, because Egypt punished those who were originally benefactors to their country. The Israelites, when they first came to Egypt, were benefactors, like Joseph saved the Egyptians from a famine. And then the Egyptians end up repaying the Israelites by enslaving them. So they're, in some ways, they're worse than the Sodomites, who had received, tried to abuse those angels. So with blindness, they were stricken. That's the men of Lot's time, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, so like as we were talking earlier, the people, they forgot the kindness of God when he saved Noah, and he did the, and you know, by Abraham, that's 1300 years later. And then the Egyptians, though, you know, by the time of the Exodus, Joseph and that famine, that was only 200 years earlier. So it really shows you how quickly people can forget generations.
And that's something I wanted to say, that Joe had said something that made me want to go in this direction. Jacob entered Egypt, and this is according to the chronology I'm preparing in my Genesis commentary. Jacob went to Egypt in 1665 BC, and he died in 1648. Joseph didn't die until 1595 BC. So that's 70 years between Jacob's arrival in Egypt and Joseph's death. So now the children of Israel only have 145 years left before the Exodus. And it's sometime after Joseph died that they were enslaved. So they did, as Solomon describes it here, the children of Israel were engaging with the Egyptians and sharing the same customs, the same laws would go along with that. And all of a sudden, the Egyptians chose to enslave them. them who had been their guests, the Israelites were guests, and they were well-honored guests when they first came to Egypt. They were given land. It seems that they were let do pretty much what they wanted to do, that they had freedoms, just like at least equivalent with the common citizens of Egypt. So sometime after 70 years, they were enslaved. And they were enslaved for as long as 140 years. Probably not quite that long, but it could be that long after Joseph died. Depending on how long after Joseph died when they became enslaved, that's something we cannot know. But they certainly were enslaved by the time of the birth of Moses, which would be about
80 years, right? Before the Exodus.
Well, if they had 145 years left, it would be about 65 years after Joseph died that Moses was born, roughly. So they were definitely enslaved within 65 years of when Joseph died, and probably a little before that. So that they became slaves when they were honored guests in this country, and they were enslaved. So that's tantamount to a man taking another man into his home as a guest and then making a slave out of him. And that's a terrible offense against God and against society.
And a complete opposite of how righteous men would treat strangers.
Yes, and it's opposite of the way God commands us to treat such strangers, such sojourners that we invite into our homes or into our countries, that we should treat them well and treat them like our own. And that's true. If you're going to abuse them, you shouldn't let them into your country. You should just ask them to leave.
With white folk, anyways. The non-white, non-folk don't have any right to be in our countries in the first place or to be treated as friends or guests.
Well, right, but they have to be driven out. Otherwise, they'll corrupt us. And you see what happens. It's all around us.
This blindness with which they were stricken, verse 17, Bill, that's actually the Egyptians in darkness, isn't it? That's not actually the angels who visited Lot. I got that mixed up.
Well, he's saying just as the angels, visited Lot.
Yes. Yeah, but it's referring to the Egyptians being blinded in the darkness.
Yeah.
Like those other men.
I don't know what I do with my VM here. There it is. I want to look for a passage here. I need a minute.
Yeah.
It's so amazing how the pillar of fire, Solomon is saying that it didn't harm the animals, it didn't harm the critters, it didn't harm Israel, but it would slay the Egyptians. And that's just so extraordinary.
Yeah, it's Yahweh can take control of the elements to protect his people, to serve them.
The King James Version has sodomites in verse 14. For the sodomites did not receive those whom they knew not when they came. And that's a lie. The word sodomite is not in the text. It's speaking about the Egyptians. For those others not knowing, did not hospitably receive those present, but it's not talking about the Egyptians. I'm sorry. It's talking about the examples that Solomon had mentioned earlier. When the children of Israel were on their sojourn. And then it says, for those others, meaning them, not knowing, did not hospitably receive those present, but these, meaning the Egyptians, had enslaved guests who were their benefactors. And that's because Joseph had actually saved Egypt out of the famine. I'm trying to get a handle on the reference to those others.
So you think it could have been the other nations as they were sojourning, or could have it been Sodom? Because Solomon refers to Sodom too.
Yeah, I think that it refers to the Sodomites, but the King James Version has Sodomites in there, and it shouldn't, because Sodomites is not found in the text. That's it. Solomon's mentioning those others before it tells us who they are, which is sort of a poetic license. It's a lot of license, right? For indeed those others not knowing did not hospitably receive those present. He didn't tell us who they are yet. But these, meaning the Egyptians, had enslaved guests who were their benefactors. And not only, but there shall be a certain visitation of them, meaning those others. So he's referring to them as those others before he tells us who they are.
And visitation is a judgment. There shall be a certain judgment upon them.
Yes. Since of what they did. Receive the strangers, that they receive the angels, that they didn't know were angels, they thought they were men, but they received them hatefully. They wanted to rape them. So that's hateful.
And then it goes back to the Egyptians, because they shared customs with the Israelites. So having been partakers of their customs, had mistreated them terribly in labors.
Right. There's a lot of terms in the Wisdom of Solomon. It gets confusing. If I don't read it from the beginning of the chapter and think about it thoroughly, it gets confusing.
Yeah, but he's just...
You have to really follow it along and do so consciously. And
yeah. But at this, from verse 14, he's just contrasting the different treatment and the different punishments between the Egyptians.
Once you read it to the point where you understand it, it's a wonderful and beautiful work of poetry. And it's also a book that's loaded with wisdom.
Yeah.
Has a fitting name.
So here's the comparison to Sodom and Egypt, that we find that they're both going to be punished. And evidently, according to Solomon, the Egyptians deserve a worse punishment than the Sodomites.
Well, what does Mystery Babylon deserve, Bill? Because where Egypt and Sodom, Mystery right. Babylon is, that's what we're living in. So what punishment do they deserve? The punishment of Egypt and Sodom, I'm thinking.
Well, even Christ said concerning the people who rejected him that they would receive a greater judgment than Sodom.
Right, he said that when he was in Galilee.
The punishment of Egypt and Sodom. So that'll be like meteors falling from the sky with like darkness and frogs everywhere.
French people everywhere. No, I'm joking.
Well, what do you think of the next chapter, Bill? The elements being adapted for all things.
That's another reference to allegories he had made earlier about the fire and the water and the ice and the snow and how the elements worked out to fulfill the will of God, to fulfill Yahweh's will and affect what he wanted those elements to affect in the punishment of Egypt. Because creation's in his hands. He could do with it what he wants.
You know that verse in Revelation where it says like the earth helped the woman as the flood of the serpent comes out of the mouth.
Yeah, that's a very good cross-reference.
It's like God can use the elements of creation to destroy the non-whites and protect Israel. And one example of that might be like the the killer whales attacking the migrant ships. You know, the earth helped the woman. Trying to think of other examples. But we haven't seen it all yet.
Something important to take away from this is the fact that history itself, all throughout history, every stage of history, is an example to men that they should learn from and look at objectively. And that's how Solomon is looking at the Exodus here. He's looking at it rather objectively. Why Egypt deserved their punishment, because even after all those plagues, they never acknowledged Yahweh as God. And why the children of Israel were saved on account of his mercy, not on account of their own doing. We should look at that as an example, and we should bear an appropriate attitude towards what's going on in the world today. Because what God decrees would happen will happen, and we can't resist it.
And God will use all the elements of creation, because he's God, to do it, to fulfill his will.
Right. And since we can't resist it, we're a hell of a lot better off observing it, studying his word to figure out why it's going on so that we can be confident in our faith, and observing it and learning from it. Because we're not going to change it. Hopefully we might pull others to follow us in that endeavor, but we're not going to change the wrath that's about to come on the society. Which is entirely caught up in idolatry.
Do you think it's interesting, Bill, that at one time Yahweh used one element to destroy the world, and at another time he's going to use a different element to destroy the world?
Fire and water?
Well, it was water in Genesis, and it's going to be fire at the end of the age, isn't it, supposedly?
Could be a metaphorical fire in the form of us, or it could be both. I'd like to imagine it's both.
Fire come down from heaven. That's a different kind of fire.
Yeah, perfectly formed from above.
I'm guessing this hail that comes down from heaven is a different kind of hail too, because it's got the fire mixed in. It's like a supernatural hail.
The hail in Revelation?
No, the hail that came down on Egypt. That was mixed with the fire, the flame.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
So it's like supernatural.
Is that in Exodus?
No, it was in an earlier chapter of this book where Solomon mentions the fire with the water. Hold on.
Oh, yeah, that is supernatural. I mean, even the manna. Like, they saw so many wonders.
It's in the last paragraph of chapter 16.
Oh, okay.
The snow and ice by the fire and did not melt, in order that they would know that fire burning in the hail and flashing in the rain had destroyed the fruits of the enemies.
Hmm.
There you go. It's supernatural hail and fire.
Right, from the perspective of men, the fire and the ice shouldn't be together in the same context, right? That they're contrary to one another.
Yes,
the fire melts the ice and the water puts out the fire.
Who were those magicians? Jambre and Giannis or something?
Jambres
and Giannis. They were out of a job.
Their little magic tricks were nothing compared to the power of God.
Paul had mentioned them in 2 Timothy chapter 3, and I have never seen what source he may have gotten that from. In one of the apocryphal books, one of them is mentioned and not the other. I don't remember if it was the book of Jasher or some other book. I don't remember. But in one apocryphal book, one of them that I've read, one of them are mentioned.
So we just don't have the book then, Bill?
No, I don't believe we do.
I want Solomon's Exodus.
I want his Genesis, too.
Yeah. I want everything we don't have. I want all the books. I want every book ever. Wars of Yahweh, everything.
That was my attitude in prison when I was doing most of my reading, and I ended up reading a lot of books that were just rabbit holes, that were garbage, that I couldn't accept as being truly inspired scriptural books. The first book of Adam and Eve, the second book of Adam and Eve, the Cave of Treasures, Second Enoch, the Secrets of Enoch, that there's even most of what we know as One Enoch is added in at a later time, and all of it is just trash.
Yeah, I've read a lot of the Apocrypha too for the exact same reason. I'm just hoping that I'll find an apocryphal book where I'm like, wow, this is like a Wisdom of Solomon type book. Look at this. This was right under our noses. But usually within the first chapter of these books, I'm like, oh, crap. Oh, no. It's saying something where it shows it's spurious right away.
Yeah, I read a great deal of the lost books of the Bible and the missing books of Eden and all that crap. It's horrible. A lot of it's horrible.
There's a lot, though. There's like 200 books. And most of them are very fragmentary and short, but there's a lot of like really small unknown ones.
Yeah, I have a couple of collections of pseudepigraphy here.
Yeah, there's a lot to go through. And yeah, it's mostly garbage.
There's a reason why it's pseudepigrapha. Even like denominational scholars don't get it wrong every time.
Like, I just realized the other day that there's like four books of Baruch. There's like four of them. I just thought there was one.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I read the Baruch that's in the Apocrypha. I got to read that again one day soon.
Yeah, there's like first Baruch, second Baruch, third Baruch. I've only read the first one in the Septuagint, and it's okay. I don't really see anything in it which is contrary to scripture. I don't really see anything in it which is new either. But then there's like a second Baruch, which I heard about. I'm like, what's this? It's like the length of Isaiah. It's huge.
I think there's a chapter in Baruch that's considered second Baruch.
Well, what book are we doing next after this? Matthew or what?
Yeah, I guess we'll do Matthew. And then as we were saying last week, we'll do Tobit in between Matthew and Mark. I think that would work great.
Yes, the portion of Baruch, which is the letter to the 9.5 tribes at the very end of Baruch, that's the book that scholars call True Baruch, Second Baruch.
Oh, okay.
And you'll see the same thing with Second Esdras. Second Esdras is usually divided by scholars into three books because it suffered several editions. So the first chapter is not original, and the last couple of chapters are not original. So they're split into 2, 3, and 4 Esdras or something like that, but by mainstream scholars.
Yeah, I read 2 Esdras a long time ago, and I was realizing this is quoting the New Testament. There's several parts in it where it just quotes the New Testament. I'm like, no, this was not written at the time of Ezra.
No, but it's hard to tell when the three parts were written.
Because yeah, you can't tell them apart, yeah.
I don't remember if it's two chapters or three, but the last several chapters are not from the same... They're not original to the central chapters, and the first chapter is not original.
So it really makes you think if there's a true second Esdras deep in there.
Right. And I would like to read that again one day also. But I won't make a commentary on any of those things. Maybe I'll make like a one-off or something on some of them sooner or later.
Yeah, I think that would be awesome. Especially Tobit. But we'll be doing Tobit soon.
Okay, David, I guess you cut the record. I don't know if we have anything more to say about the wisdom of Solomon. Anybody?
It's an incredible book. And it should be right where Esther is in the Bible, and Esther should be ripped out and burned for all eternity.
Criticize me. There were CI people actually criticized me for upholding the wisdom of Solomon as a canonical book.
Well, they're fools.
And why is that?
Because they just don't. I guess they read Wikipedia or something. I don't know.
The book speaks for itself. Doesn't really matter what anyone says about it. You can read it. You can see it speaks for itself.
There is so much in the Wisdom of Solomon that supports our view of Scripture. I don't know how anybody that's an identity Christian could despise it. And there is so much evidence that the Wisdom of Solomon was counted as canonical as late as the 4th and 5th centuries. It was part of the Codex Sinaiticus. It was part of the Codex Alexandrinus. I don't know how anybody could just dismiss it that easily, as if they are better experts than people who lived in the 4th century, or than the apostles who were clearly inspired by Solomon, by the wisdom of Solomon. I don't know how they could think that they're better experts than the men who actually lived through these things 2,000 years ago. Because they read Wikipedia, perhaps.